طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. In our broadcast this morning, we continue our examination of the so-called Israeli normalization process. The Trump administration and the government of Israel, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have devised a Middle East peace plan without the involvement of Palestinian leaders and have concluded agreements to normalize relations between Israel and a widening circle of Arab regimes, the so-called Abraham Accords. Today our program is taken from a webinar forum sponsored by the Center for Islam Decoloniality, hosted by Ziad Mustafa Ali. It is focused on Pakistan, which is currently under pressure to join the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia, and others, in treaties to normalize relationships between their countries and Israel. This panel, consisting of Israeli historian Ilan Pappe, foreign policy analyst Phyllis Bennis, and religious scholar Mark Braverman. The forum begins with introductions by host Ziad Mustafa Ali.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Danish TV's English language channel, the global voice of the Center for Islam and Decoloniality. Once again, we are continuing our series on an incredibly pressing issue right now, confronting Pakistan foreign policy, and that is the question of normalization with Israel, which, you know, in some sense, should not even be up for debate. But unfortunately, there are incredible pressures being placed on the Pakistani state by so-called brotherly Muslim countries, as well as the United States, to normalize. And the Pakistani state finds itself in a very difficult position, despite the fact that our prime minister has said no less than 14 times that there's no way that we will normalize until the following conditions are met. And so, but still, the pressure remains. It's an ongoing issue. And this is why this particular show, I don't want to say that the previous ones were inadequate in any way, but this particular show for me is very, very important, because one of the myths that Western propaganda, and which has, of course, penetrated throughout the Islamicate world as well, has been that this is primarily a religious conflict that is taking place between Muslims and Jews, or Muslim and Christians and Jews, or and all of that. And so I think that that is an incredibly wrong way to see this problem. And I think we have individuals here of Jewish background, who can certainly dispel that mythology. And I think it's an incredibly esteemed panel in which there really is no time to go into the enormous contributions they have made in the struggle for the justice of Palestine. I'll just introduce them individually. Professor Ilan Pappe, perhaps the foremost historian on the question of modern Palestine, and his books, History of Modern Palestine, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestinians, so on and so forth, well-respected throughout the world at the University of Exeter in UK, and a dear friend and a dear mentor of mine. And so welcome, Professor Pappe. We have Phyllis Bennis, another dear friend who's with the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., also on the board of Jewish Voices for Peace. And again, has her contributions, her works on both the U.S. imperial policy, but particularly focusing on the Middle East and the very skewed kind of honest broker mythology of the United States within that the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and again her work and her activism in promoting justice for the Palestinians. And finally, we have my dear friend Mark Reverman, who is a psychologist. He's also associated with Kairos USA and the global Kairos movement, which I will want him to kind of speak about when he will be addressing the question of kind of his own background and his own involvement in this movement. So we are limited in terms of time. So I want to get straight into the discussion, and I want specifically our Pakistani and larger, the Islamicate world, Muslim populations to listen very carefully to what is being said today. And but of course, all of our global viewership, because we right now have three of the preeminent public intellectuals speaking on an issue which they fear very dearly about and have been working towards that justice for Palestinians that I'm speaking, that I've referred to earlier. So I want to start off this issue. Of course, the larger question, which we'll get to in a moment, is of course the issue of this normalization and why now and why not to do it. But before that, for our viewership that may not know what Israel has represented in the Middle East, I wanted Professor Ilan Pape, our esteemed historian, to in a nutshell, despite his thousands of pages of writings on this, but in a nutshell, the Zionist movement, what is Zionism, which many people don't even know, what is the Zionist movement, how it led to the creation of Israel, and what is Israel, and the consequences of the creation of that Israel settler colonial state. So if you could very briefly, in about 4 to 5 minutes, speak to that, Professor Pape.
Yes, thank you, Junaid. It's a great pleasure to be on this TV show and to share the podium with such two great friends and intellectuals. in a nutshell, you use the word that I think describes Zionism best, and this is settler colonialism, which means that this is a movement of Jews in the late 19th century who were running away from persecution in Europe. And like so many other people who were persecuted in Europe, turned their operation of salvation into an operation of colonization. They chose a land where someone else already lived. And as the late Patrick Wolves has taught us, when settlers arrive at the place where indigenous native people live, they are motivated by the logic of the elimination or the removal of the native. It's a project of displacement and replacement that a number of Jews was able to start in the late 19th century after the First World War, with the help of Britain, were able to turn their dream into a reality. Until the 1930s, they were busy in building a stronghold or a foothold in historical Palestine. But from the 1930s onwards, and especially during the Second World War and towards the end of the British rule in Palestine, they began planning and contemplating the second phase of Zionism, which was the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, the native indigenous people of Palestine, and to remove them so as to create as much as possible a pure Jewish state. The fact that they were unsuccessful in a way, they only, in brackets, succeeded in removing half of the population and taking over 80% of Palestine, not the whole 100%, meant that there was still a Palestinian national movement, an anti-colonialist movement, trying to defend the land that still was theirs and trying to deal with the major catastrophe that the Zionist movement brought upon them in 1948, which the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe. After the British left Palestine, the Zionist forces expelled half of Palestine's population, demolished half of Palestine's villages, and destroyed most of the Palestinian towns. Zionism, therefore, became this settler-colonial ideology that brought this horrible catastrophe upon the Palestinians in 1948. Zionism after 1948 is the ideology that justifies the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the continued to the project of displacement and replacement. In 1967, Israel took over the 20% or so that it did not manage to take in 48, and it was still faced with a significant number of Palestinians inside Israel. And much of its policies towards Palestine and the Palestinians is still motivated by the Zionist dream of having, instead of an Arab Palestine, a Jewish Palestine. It's an ideology that tries to justify the creation of an ethnic apartheid racist state and try to sell it as a democracy because they are all for a Jewish majority at all cost, and there's no means that they will not use to ensure that majority. So it's an ideology, it's not a religion. It's an ideology of a settler colonial movement that became an ideology of a state that has a lot of similarities to the ideology of apartheid South Africa, but has much better public relations than apartheid South Africa had, and therefore much of what it stands for and how it is translated into oppressive policies against the Palestinians is hidden from the public eye. And I think our role is, of course, to expose it and explain that there are alternatives for this kind of relationship between the settler community now in its third generation and the indigenous native people of Palestine still fighting for freedom, independence, and self-determination.
Wonderful. Thank you. I want to turn to Phyllis Bennis, one of the foremost kind of policy analysts that I know of on the Middle East, in the United States, in the world, in fact. Phyllis, what Professor Pape has laid out kind of some of the history of it. I wanted to move to very more contemporary times, contemporary, say, moving from the attempts, the so-called attempts by the United States or the international community to say that, okay, that this conflict, we need to resolve it now. And particularly beginning, of course, the talks had begun in Madrid before, but leading up to the Oslo agreements, 93, that many people celebrated as a great breakthrough. Other more astute analysts did not see it as the type of thing to as the panacea for the problem. So if Phyllis, you can speak about what between Oslo till today, the deal of the century that has been promoted. What has this peace process been all about? Has it delivered anything good for the Palestinians?
Well, thanks, Junaid. Thanks for the invitation to join you today. It's great to be on with my old friends as well. You know, this discussion of the so-called peace process is a very important one, and it doesn't get interrogated nearly enough, particularly here in the United States, which is very much the center of this so-called process. The real issue here is on what does it mean to call it a peace process? I think many people in Pakistan and elsewhere will be familiar with one of the most important contributions of Dr. Martin Luther King, who taught us all what the definition of peace is and is not. Dr. King said that peace is not just the absence of war, the absence of conflict, but the presence of justice. The presence of justice. And in this case, what we see in this so-called peace process is that it's all about process. There's a whole industry. There's people who have spent entire careers in the US State Department and in a host of Israeli and Palestinian and international institutions of various sorts participating in the various processes involved with this, who have spent 25, 30 years carrying this out. But the definition of peace that it was based on is precisely the opposite of Dr. King's definition. This is precisely the absence of war on one side without any presence of justice, without even the pretense of justice. So the focus was all from the beginning, from the time of Oslo, the focus was on the creation of the apparatus of a state, not the reality of a state, because a state implies independence, control of your own borders, control of your airspace, control of your waters, control of who comes in and who goes out, control of your economy, none of which were offered to the Palestinians. This was not a state that was being offered. This was a series of non-contiguous pieces of territory, similar in certain ways, as Ilan referenced earlier, to apartheid South Africa. Many differences, probably more differences than similarities, but certain things were similar, including this notion of a kind of Bantustan arrangement where certain pieces of the state, what would be called a state, would be given certain amounts of Palestinian autonomy without any real independence. And it was crucially focused on this idea of creating something that could be called a state without any actual rights. Human rights were not on the agenda. Independence was not on the agenda. Freedom for Palestinians was not on the agenda. So it left in place the displacement and replacement that Ilan spoke of. It left all of that in place. And now, of course, these years later, after there was Oslo, there were series of other conferences that were supposed to expand Oslo and redefine Oslo and all of that. None of that ever really created anything close to an independent state. And now the idea of a Palestinian state is really not on the agenda. Whatever anyone thinks about it, was it a good idea or not a good idea? I have my own critiques of it, but I'm not a Palestinian or an Israeli, so it's not really my call. But whatever one thinks about whether it was a good idea or not, it's no longer an option because there is no land left available for an actual state. There is a non-contiguous set of little pieces of land. Nothing is viable. There's no independence being discussed. And the result is what we're seeing is the possibilities now with the new normalization processes underway with a number of countries and Israel, the normalization of this false resolution where there is no solution, no justice for Palestinian refugees who were driven out in 1948 and then again in 1967, no resolution for the situation in Gaza, no resolution for the second-class citizenship of Palestinians who are indeed citizens of Israel, but without anything close to equality, and the continuation of occupation, colonial settlements being built and expanded. So the idea of a state is really not on the agenda. And what's on the agenda now, not framed by Oslo, is the idea of rights, Palestinian rights and equality for all. That's what I think the discussion has brought us to after these years of a so-called peace process.
Absolutely. And this deal of the century, did it have any meaning, Phyllis?
Well, it was one more example in the Trump era of offering money. You know, right. It was throwing around a lot of money. In this case, it was Saudi money, as it so often is, and UAE money, as it so often is, offering it to Palestinians saying, if you build up some kind of a better capitalist economy with our money, we will do something. It wasn't clear what, because they still were not offering actual independence, equality, or any of the rights that Palestinians have actually fought for. It was essentially saying, we will give you a better standard of living. Keep in mind that right now, Gaza, as of an announcement of the United Nations 5 years ago, who said that in 2020, Gaza will be unlivable. Wow. Well, it's 2021 now. 2020 has passed. Gaza is unlivable, uninhabitable, and yet it is inhabited by 2 million people, the majority of them under the age of 18, the majority are children. And they are left to their own devices without anything remotely resembling rights, equality, even sufficient food, the obligations of Israel as the occupying power for providing medical care, providing clean water, providing food. None of that is taken seriously. So in this context, the so-called deal of the century was an offer of throw some money at the Palestinians and hope that they, number one, shut up and stop complaining, and number two, that many of them leave, leaving us, the Israelis, the land without the people.
Right, right. Thank you very much, Phyllis. An excellent analysis of what's been going on since particularly the Oslo so-called peace accords. And I want to turn now to Mark Breverman. And Mark, I wanted you specifically to speak about your growing up in from a Jewish background, and also in at a time where I believe where the being enamored with kind of this Zionist dream and so on. I mean, not just for you, but for many Jews. And then how did your own kind of trajectory of your political trajectory of in some ways escaping the blinders that kind of the Zionist mythology had in some ways the Zionist mythology had addressed the Palestinian issue as basically, I mean, the Palestinians being kind of non-existent and this being as Professor Pape said, a land without a people, for a people without a land. So I want, if you don't mind, that kind of, I think the personal story of yours and your then involvement in Kairos, the Global Kairos Movement, which you can talk about, if you don't mind kind of speaking about that'd be great.
Yes, so my personal journey, my personal story in some ways is, to me anyway, is very, very instructive. I was born into a traditional Jewish family in 1948 on the East Coast of the United States. And if you were born into that environment, you're raised in a very potent combination of rabbinic traditional Judaism and traditional and political Zionism. Mm. And what's happened to Judaism since 1948, and the stage was set before that, was that the two have really emerged. And so we, and you've said this as well, Junaid, it's not a religious conflict. It's very much about politics, about, as Phyllis says, about human rights, and about how Israel, the part that Israel plays now in the big geopolitical, broad geopolitical program of preserving neoliberalism and neocolonialism, for want of a better word, and Israel is a key asset for the major forces at play in the world today, for maintaining and preserving that system of perpetuating the Eurocentric white patriarchal colonial system that after World War I, where the world was rearranged, but the power is needed to preserve that, and that continues to this day. I've gotten very involved in working with the churches over the last close to two decades about that, and I want to be able to talk a little bit about how I see the importance of that in terms of organizing today, our organizing strategy today to combat this, and to encourage the Muslim audience that we have here to, as possible, translate that into a Muslim context as well.
Mark, you mentioned you've been working with Christians, but one of the things that I did want to kind of, I think you have something to speak about, particularly being in the United States, is of course this phenomenal tendency of Christian Zionism as well, that many of us don't know much about as well. So maybe you can also mention
I want to touch. I was getting to that because Christian Zionism is a huge force. Yeah. I mean, the church, you know, you can go back to the 4th century on this, the 3rd century of Constantine, but the church was hugely important, providing the sort of theological and sort of theocratic basis and rationale and heft for the European colonialism at its beginnings in the 15th century with the Age of Discovery. You had the priests blessing the slave ships as they landed in Lisbon, and And that has continued, and it had a resurgence at the end of the 19th century with the rise of political Zionism, and in particular with the influence of Britain and later the United States in playing a key role in their geopolitical aims, but also being able to tap into a deep well of belief on the part, again, of what Western Europeans about who the Jews were. I think it's deeply anti-Semitic to be able to see the Jews as special and as wanting to send them back, you know, to their birthplace, get them the hell out of here. But it also, in a perfect storm, sort of interacted with the geopolitical aims of the powers after World War I, where in a rearranged world, they wanted to hold on to their colonial agenda. And we see that today in its modern iteration, where, again, Israel is a key asset in this endeavor. And I think that's the context, one lens which we can use to understand the pressure that is on Pakistan today to join in the effort to bring the Arab, the rest of the Arab world, or the Muslim world, into this coalition to preserve that Israel seem, when we talk about Israel as the, quote, last democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East, what it really means is there are people, our meaning the United States, Britain, Western Europe, and their allies, to preserve the order that we desperately want to preserve in the face of the upsurge of the global South and the people saying, no, we don't want this. This is not good for us. And that's, I think, what I've been learning about Pakistan today. That's the hope and the miracle of Pakistan, that it represents the possibility that the actual people, their voice, can have an actual impact on the political process so that you have a leader who is saying no to this. And if you listen to Professor Abu Khalil in the last session, he said the leadership of most of these countries does not represent the will of the people. The will of the people is different, which is why, and I'm going to talk about this if I have a chance later, the global Christian movement from the grassroots, the church movement from the grassroots, is exactly that. Christians at the grassroots who understand what it means to be a follower of Jesus, which means to destroy the temples and to destroy the seats of power in a nonviolent way if possible, but if you have to be violent, that's okay. And to say these must go and the will of the people must come up. And we're hearing that from South Africa. The churches in South Africa had a huge role in the removal of the apartheid government. It's an untold story, that in the end of the Cold War. Southern Asia, India now has a large movement. Southern Asia, Eastern Asia as well, Western Asia as well as Latin America. You see these grassroots movements. The churches are making it a Christian movement, but they're really trying. They're really in India, for example. They're allied with the Dalit movement in Europe and Latin America, and in Europe there's a real alliance with labor and with student movements. So there's a real hope here if we think about this paradigm of protests against institutional, meaning both institutions of religion as well as institutions of government, who want to preserve the current power structure and the power and the force of the grassroots to make a difference. And we have historical precedents for that, with the anti-apartheid movement, with the civil rights movement in the United States, with the program to combat racism from the World Council of Churches back in the 60s, another fairly untold story. We have historical precedents, and for me, this is the hope that in the face of where we see things going, this is where we need to put our energy.
The second and final question, because I don't want to get kicked off the show myself by Mr. Shai Dhawan, who runs the show, is basically the theme of this program. Why should Pakistan, or any other country for that matter, not normalize relations with Israel despite whatever pressure is coming from certain Gulf countries, from the United States, from Israel itself, of course? Why should it not normalize? Of course, we now, you've laid the framework of kind of the cruelties and injustices that have been inflicted. But again, for our audiences that still see that, okay, well, maybe would this perhaps be allow Pakistan or other countries to maybe mitigate the suffering of the Palestinians? There are some questions there. Most people, of course, are on the side of not normalizing. But still, I want our three esteemed guests to make the case of why not to normalize with Israel. And the second part of that, what is the way forward? How can we continue to resist globally and show our solidarity with the Palestinians? Professor Pape, can we begin with you?
Yes, thank you. So let me start with the first question. It is important not to normalize a relationship, especially for a Muslim country, with a country that would use this normalization as an umbrella of immunity to continue oppressive policies against people, the vast majority of whom are Muslims themselves. So I think that you have to realize what normalization means. It means that you are building a shield around Israel that allows it to continue the daily and systematic abuse of the Palestinians' human rights and civil rights, and continue to solidify its apartheid state and its colonization project, which has not ended yet. And as much as the Palestinians have suffered, there's still, unfortunately, still some plans to inflict even more suffering on them. So that's what a normalization would do. You would be an accomplice to a criminal policies and to perpetuating an injustice without its resolution, there is very little hope for stability, peace, and progress in the Middle East as a whole. As for the way forward for the international community, I think we now know for certain that the dominant American involvement, as Phyllis has explained to us, rightly so, in the so-called peace process has not only not bring with it peace, it had a negative and destructive impact on the reality. So we need to take the United States, to my mind, outside from its, or to remove it from the prominent role it plays in the history and the present realities in Israel and Palestine, maybe in the Middle East as a whole. And we should actually seek countries outside of the Middle East, such as Pakistan, such as Malaysia, as Indonesia, and ask them to play a role that was never played by the West, of the honest broker, not the dishonest broker, and to show solidarity with the Palestinian people, because, and this will be my last point, the move forward in terms of international solidarity with the Palestinians, whether by indigenous people, African Americans, oppressed workers, and so on, this solidarity cannot be stopped by normalization agreements, because people rightly equate social justice and justice in their own countries with justice for the Palestinians. But it means that if governments, and this would include the government of Pakistan, do not show that kind of affinity and solidarity, it means that they are not faithfully representing the will of their own people. This is part of a larger question of human rights and civil rights. And therefore, I think the way forward is to continue with this symbolic support for Palestine as something that really embodies many of the struggles for justice in the world. And we just let us hope that there will be a united Palestinian liberation movement that would be able to exploit this amazing energy and support to change the reality on the ground. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Professor Pape. Phyllis, the same question put to you. Why not normalize, and what is the way forward?
You know, it's very important how that we think about what Ilan has been saying about what normalization means. The word is misleading. Normalization is not something that is usual and normal. It's making normal a thoroughly abnormal situation. In this moment, when we see these so-called normalization agreements between Israel and a number of other countries, particularly Arab countries, the UAE, Sudan is under discussion, Morocco in a new one. You know, these are not new agreements, in fact. What they are is the making public existing private, put to the side agreements that have existed for a long time. It's why we hear that Saudi Arabia may be next, because the Saudis have been dealing with Israel for a long time, but not publicly. It's not acknowledged. They claim to be boycotting or whatever it is they claim. But like the UAE, like Morocco, there have been relations. They've been quiet. They've been on the side. This is really like a coming out party more than new agreements. These are not countries that were at war with Israel. So what does it mean to have a peace agreement? These were friendly countries that had business agreements, security agreements, and we should be clear that they are getting stuff for this. The UAE got $23 billion worth of arms sales from the United States. Morocco has now gotten sort of the green light on Western Sahara from the United States. So it's the United States that is giving to these countries, to these governments, a gift in return for their going public with what the governments, not the people, what the governments have wanted to do, which is to have normal diplomatic and strategic and economic and other kinds of relations with the Israeli state. There is a legacy in Pakistan that we need to remember, the legacy of the U.S. effort to mobilize support in the United Nations to go to war against Iraq. In 2002, 2003, Pakistan was already a close ally of the United States. This is under the dictatorship, but still Pakistan as a country, as a government, was linked to the United States effort to go to war against Afghanistan. My understanding is that there was a lot of opposition to that among the Pakistani people, but nonetheless, Pakistan was a key ally of the U.S. in going to war against Afghanistan. But when the threat of war with Iraq emerged and the U.S. and the Brits tried to get the Security Council to pass a resolution that would endorse a new war against Iraq, that was something that Pakistan said no. And it was part of what were known as the uncommitted six, the six members of the Security Council who were there as elected members. It was three African countries, Angola, Cameroon, and Guinea, plus two Latin American countries, Mexico and Chile, and Pakistan. And those six stood up to the pressure of the United States, and the sky didn't fall. Right. There were no consequences. They were able to do that because, one, there were a number of countries doing it together, saying no to the U.S. pressure, both powerful countries that included France and Germany and Russia and China, and smaller, not so strong countries like Cameroon and Guinea and the other countries that were very frightened about what the consequences would be. But they stood together because the other pressure point was in their capitals, from Islamabad to the capitals of Santiago and Mexico City and all of them. People were storming into those capitals demanding that their governments stand up to the U.S. and say no to George Bush's war in Iraq. And it gave rise to the biggest global movement against a war that has ever been built. And it's in that context that I think we need to look at what's going to, coming to the last part of your question, what do we do now? We build movements. We build movements demanding support for the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. We build movements to prevent our own governments, wherever we are around the world, from buying arms or buying high-tech security equipment from Israeli companies, because that has become so central to the Israeli legitimation of their occupation and of their role in the region. So there are many things, but they all come back, as Mark said earlier, they all come back to building social movements. And it's the combination of those movements with governments, when there are governments that are willing to listen to their people, that we will see real change in the diplomatic and political and international arena within which the Palestinians themselves continue their fight for freedom, for equality, for human rights.
And finally, Mark, can I ask you the same question? Why not to normalize? But also, when you speak about kind of the way forward, your own experience as part of this Kairos, yeah, Global Kairos, and I know you've spoken about kind of Christian solidarity going on with the Palestinians, but also more and more Jewish voices that have been able to escape the kind of hegemonic Zionist narrative within many of the Western democracies and so on, and in the U.S. and elsewhere, and that more and more are coming out and being fair and being critical of what the state of Israel is doing. Please, Mark.
Yes, and just to make sure that I emphasize that point, it's not just the three of us renegade Jews here who represent Jewish voices. There's a huge and growing movement of Jews today, especially young Jews, but also old people like us, who have become proudly anti-Zionist because of their strong identification as Jews and because of their deep commitment to their Jewish background, which is what happened to me. I realized that meeting the Palestinians and frankly also being introduced to Christian liberation theology and who Jesus really was, which was a grassroots organizer in first century Palestine, occupied Palestine, made me the best Jew that I could ever be. Mm-hmm. So we are not alone, and our tribe is increasing. So it's good to know that. And I think that is a message that I would want to I've certainly learned that from the Christians that I know. And my hope would be that is something that is a real process that's going on in the Muslim world as well, and in particular Pakistan, which I'm now just really learning about from you and from this whole process. The question that you asked is why is normalization not a good thing? And I would echo what Phyllis and Ilan have said, which is nothing normal about this. Right. It's horrible, and it's the worst thing that can happen. And it's bad for Pakistan. Normalization is bad for Pakistan. I think it was Ramzi Baroud who made the point in your last program that what does it mean for the credibility and the effectiveness and the program of your prime minister, who is really successfully bringing on, in the face of a background of military dictatorships and authoritarianism, a social democracy, for want of a better word. And what does it mean when his people see that the hypocrisy of a line with Israel, which represents everything that he does not stand for? So, I mean, it's not something that he can do, and that has to be resisted, and he has to get all the support he can get for doing that. And I'm glad to see that you're doing your best to help with that process. But it's not only bad for Pakistan, it's bad for the world, because Pakistan is part of the global south, which is a weird right expression because it's not a geographic designation. Basically, it means the formerly colonized countries and nations and peoples of the world, as opposed to the North or the West, which was the people who did the colonization and who still want to be in control. And so we see this in South Africa, and we see this in Asia, and we see this in Latin America, and in other places, even within the formerly colonized countries. But we also see an enormous threat, which is the rise of authoritarianism and right-wing governments. So the rise of and the resurgence of the global south is just incredibly important and needs to be supported. And I see Pakistan as kind of a, not to idealize it, but it's kind of as a miracle or a trailblazer here. I would say actually also along with South Africa, we think and Latin America also, which is struggling very, very much from a Christian point of view with the resurgence of conservative Christianity, which is flying all the worst flags that can fly to try to bring people in. politically and
socially. And Mark, sorry to interrupt you. Just I do want you to inform the audience, what is this Kairos movement, Kairos Global?
Yeah, okay, so in 2009, the Palestinians, a group of, again, very, very similar to South Africa, a small group, Christian activists, allies elsewhere in the country, and they were closely allied and actually supported the ANC. And even as Christians, they wrote a wonderful document that South Africans saying, you know, as Christians, we wouldn't pick up a gun, but we support the armed struggle. Very, very, very important and very Gandhian in many ways. Following their lead in 2009, and this was back in the 80s in South Africa, following their lead in 2009, and the South Africans, this small group of Christians, Alan Busack, Desmond Tutu, and many, many other people who are unsung heroes, brought the entire Christian world, the entire ecumenical Christian world, to their support. And that's what ultimately helped turn the Thatcher governments and the Reagan governments to support the sanctions. And that was hugely important in bringing down the apartheid government. So in 2009, the Palestinian Christians, ecumenical group of Palestinian Christians, which was itself a miracle, get a bunch of Christian denominations from Orthodox to Lutheran together. It was amazing. Wrote a very prophetic document, prophetic in the sense of it being theologically prophetic, straight liberation theology, gorgeous stuff. And reaching out to the world and say, here is what is happening to us. You have no idea what the mythology of Israel is. Listen to what's really going on here. And we're speaking to you Christians, and we're speaking to you brown and black people, and we're speaking to you people across the world who believe in human rights. Think of South Africa. Think of us, because that's what's going on, and it's even worse. And that made a big difference. And the Christian world, starting with the Christian world, and there's the analogy. You know, the civil rights movement in the United States started with black Christians, and it spread to Christians all over the country, and then to the entire society. So that was the kernel, but it was that spiritual spark, that core of radical opposition to tyranny, which is where the church got its birth, and there probably are analogies in Islam as well, has sparked, and this is now close to more than a decade ago, a global network of grassroots groups in every continent, in every country, that are militating within, you know, vertically within their own institutions, which of course are conservative and are allied with power and all that stuff, to take a stand and say, just like we finally were dragged into opposing South Africa, just as we were finally dragged into opposing racism in the 60s, and, you know, the World Council of Churches funded, gave money, millions of dollars, to armed national liberation movements in Africa. And they were called terrorists, and they were called all kinds of things, and they did it. So there are precedents for this. And so Global Kairos for Justice, which is the hub of it, is a small group of activists, Christian activists in Palestine, with some heads of churches, as well, who are now mobilized, and perhaps later you can go to Palestine, KairosPalestine .com or .org, and you will find it. Go to KairosUSA.org, go to PalestinePortal.org, and you will find rich resources for what this movement is about. They're strongly connected to BDS, which is the best thing that we have. It is taking on Christian Zionism frontally. So because we have a theological battleground going on here. You know, this is not a secular world. Not when you leave Europe. The rest of the world is not a secular world. And that's why it's so important to enlist people whose faith traditions and their association identification with religious movements is the center of their lives. And either it's going to be, they're going to be led by theologians and church leaders who say, you stay with power, you work with us, and we'll take care of you. Or they're going to say, well, no, we know that you're wrong and you're connected with the wrong people and your ideology is wrong, and we are going to rise up and work for a better world.
Wonderful.
So I have an enormous amount of hope and confidence. It's an organizing strategy. And it's important, I think, for what's happening in the Christian world to make those alliances with Muslims, with Jews, with Buddhists, with Hindus, with people who don't identify, identify as secular, so their religion is labor or their religion is human rights. That's fine. These alliances have to happen. And the momentum and the enormous energy and guidance that's been given by the Palestinians can be important because it's bigger than Palestine. People respond to Palestine because it's bigger than Palestine. And it has to do with the global order that has to be unsettled, not just the struggle of 6 million Palestinians and 12 million around the world. It's a small group of people, but it's powerful, and it's powerful also because they're connected with the Holy Land and with the tradition that is so important to Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And so people go to Palestine, and if they see what there is to be seen and not what the tourist track shows them, they immediately get it. African Americans, if you send your folks from Pakistan to go and do a religious pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to the Haram al-Sharif, let them see what's going on in Jerusalem and around the Haram al-Sharif. And they will come back and tell their prime minister, there's no way you can normalize with this.
Right. Absolutely, Mark. Absolutely, Mark. What a wonderful way to end this conversation. And you're absolutely right. I think that Palestine, in some ways, the cruelties and injustices we've been speaking about in Palestine, Palestine is a metaphor for the global, in some ways, the ongoing coloniality of the world system in which cruelties and injustices are taking place throughout the world. So it is a metaphor in some ways. The solidarity with the Palestinians means solidarity with all oppressed groups throughout the world.
You have been listening to a forum hosted by Ziad Mustafa Ali of the Center for Islam Decoloniality, and featuring Ilan Pape, Phyllis Bennis, and Mark Braverman, discussing the issue of the so-called process of normalization of relationships between Israel and surrounding Muslim regimes. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m.
You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم